Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Rakoff, whose latest collection of essays is called Don't Get Too Comfortable. The first collection was called Fraud. David Rakoff does pieces for This American Life. He writes for GQ, Outside, New York Times Magazine, New York Observer, Vogue, several other places. These essays, some of them were written specifically for the book?
Yes, many of them were written specifically for the book. This book, far more than the previous book, has stuff that was written exclusively for the book. And as it was the case with the other book as well, even pieces that began their lives elsewhere are significantly rewritten for the book in order to, it is hoped, you know, have some sort of sustained narrative arc and thematic unity, more or less.
What would you call the thematic unity and narrative arc of Don't Get Too Comfortable?
Well, one would hope there was kind of a little bit of a humorous yet cranky screed about the times in which we find ourselves, which is this point in history where avarice, you know, and greed seems to have been transformed from being a vice to a virtue. And it's sneakier than it was in the 1980s. I mean, when Michael Douglas's Gordon Gekko said greed is good, there was always that sense that, well, of course, look at him. He's got the slick back hair and the yellow pin dot tie and everything. And one could really sort of go through life saying, well, there's them and then there's the rest of us who are not greedy. So nowadays, all that has kind of been effaced in a way, and the kind of ascendant value of money and affluence is all concealed under this seemingly austere, pared-down, non-ostentatious, you know, it looks like it's not ostentatious, but it's in fact precisely the same kind of greed that brought us the, you know, poof skirts, big shoulder pads, vulgarity of the 1980s. But it's sneakier, and it also seems to have pervaded everything.
Perfect example of that is, say, looking at a hotel like Bellagio in Vegas, which tries to keep it down a little bit, but somehow becomes even more excessive in trying to keep it down.
Well, I've never been there, but yeah, absolutely. I stayed in one hotel room where it was essentially a surgery. You know, the floor was white, the bed was white, and, you know, the white Phalaenopsis orchid, which is meant to evoke, you know, serenity.
When I think of Gordon Gekko and the Greed is Good speech, I keep thinking Oliver Stone put that in there as a satire, and yet now people would quote it
as a mantra.
Right, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This collection of essays, a couple of the pieces that got to me, one is a piece called Beat Me Daddy, which is about the Log Cabin Republicans, which appeared in GQ magazine.
The origins of writing the piece were that it was an assignment for GQ. I'm on contract with GQ. But I was very fortunate in terms of this whole notion of greed and avarice and culture of excess had really been a bee in my bonnet for a long, long time. And clearly I had gassed on about it to everybody I knew because all of the assignments that I was getting were suited to that. There was somehow people twigged to the fact that this is what I was angry about and funny about and wanted to write about. So I was approached by, you know, my editor at GQ saying, would you like to write about the gay Republicans? And my response was, would I? Of course I would. And it was a really interesting and saddening experience because the guys that I met, you know, the executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans and his then head of media relations or whatever, that guy's gone now, I really liked him. I really respected on some level his commitment to public service. This is a man who is really interested in the things that politics can do to improve the life of the people. Unfortunately, in my opinion, he's allied himself with causes that not only are hell-bent on his own destruction as a gay man, but are just wrong, societally wrong. But I really liked him. And for the duration of the time that we spoke and sort of hung out and the story was going on before it appeared in print, because after it appeared in print, I never heard from him again. No doubt, I wouldn't call someone who wrote a piece like that about me either. But for that time, we really got along well. He's smart. One thinks of one's political adversaries or people who hold different politics from one. If you think about them as idiots, you do so at your own peril. Clearly, people aren't idiots. They can be wrong, and I think he is wrong. But he wasn't stupid, and I really respected that. And again, I just respected being with somebody who wasn't working in the media, wasn't working in retail, wasn't writing a screenplay. That alone is impressive to me. At the same time, I found it eminently depressing that ultimately It's one of these things where, you know those Vasarely paintings, and some people see the squares as concave and some people see the squares as convex. You can't somehow explain to people who don't understand the notion of a social contract. The notion of society is that we take care of one another, because otherwise life is nasty, brutish, and short. That's what you do. You take care of people. It's a, you know, you knit this fabric because, guess what? One's well-being and one's sense of well-being is an incredibly precarious thing. That's sort of what is the entire title of the book, which is, you can go from being a healthy person to a sick person, for example, in the blink of an eye. And it's an entirely different kingdom, being in the realm of the sick. You can live one paycheck away from homelessness. All these things, these best laid plans in one's life, are
ephemeral,
complete illusions. You know, And so you have to go through your life understanding that there really is no division between you and, like, you know, for to use a completely drama queeny example, the urine-soaked drunk on the street. You know, on some level, he's somebody's son. He's somebody's brother. So that sense is like, that. Those are the convex squares. That's the way I was raised to think of government. This is what taxation does. It creates an infrastructure, all that stuff. The Republican tenets are concave. It's like, no, it's me. I'm going to look out for number one. Smaller government, you know, which I think is a load of crap. So he and I never arrived at the same conclusion in terms of that sort of stuff.
You go back to something else, which is, this is a guy who is putting his time and energy into supporting policies that, going in a certain direction 10 years from now, could make what he does sexually illegal, and 30 years from now could put him in a concentration camp. And you start thinking about that. That's what the goals of the people that he's, quote, in bed with.
Yes, it's really bizarre. I mean, I liken it in the book to meeting a cow who says, oh, this is my loin and this is my rump. You'll find my primary particularly tasty. Here, let me pour the A1 steak sauce all over my head for you. It's very weird to meet someone who seems to be a member of a species calling for his own demise.
David Rakoff, before we go into a couple of other of these essays, I'd like you to comment on something that is not particularly in your book, though it kind of plays a subtext role, which is the celebrity culture that we've got today, the focus on celebrity.
It's completely taken over the media in this really disheartening way. I've been fortunate enough, just as a freelance writer, not to have to do a lot of celebrity profiles and stuff. On those rare occasions when I have had to interview people who are celebrities as opposed to public figures, or as opposed to just people who are, you know, in the news, you have to deal with a publicist. Here's the thing. I have a publicist who's did my book tour, so it's not like I'm unfamiliar with what they do, but it is maddening to find oneself being given sugar-coated marching orders. I shut down immediately. The other thing about celebrity culture, which I'm finding disheartening, and I guess it's a situation, a cultural moment in which we find ourselves in general, is the notion that the words fame and notoriety would be different has been eradicated. Things that used to be acts or circumstances in your life that would send you out of the public eye for the rest of your life in shame are now legitimate career launchers for your second act. Paris Hilton released a sex tape. You know, it's a tape of her having sex with someone on camera. The notion that she had no part in its release is simply a fiction. You can't actually release a tape of somebody having sex on camera without their tacit consent. She has parents. It strikes me as so morally bankrupt, and yet it only seems to make her more legitimate. It's that kind of thing. There used to be a sense, or maybe I'm just misremembering it, but there used to be a sense that one had to have some kind of virtuosity, let alone virtue. I mean, forget virtue. But you had to be good at something. You had to have a skill set other than the capacity to stay out at night late and, you know, pose for photographers who were photographing you in a restaurant. And that is so depressing to me.
How does David Rakoff get his book to number one on the bestseller list? Well, obviously, if he robbed a bank.
Oh, well, there's certainly that. And look, I'm not unmindful of it. I'm promoting a book. And I'm hoping for prominence. It's how I make my living. So it's a double-edged thing for me. I'm not unaware of the sort of weird territory I find myself in.
In terms of what you were talking about a moment ago, you said you have not taken any assignments where you have to interview these celebrities. Have there been assignments that they've made to you and GQ has approached you on and you've said, I simply can't do it?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them.
And it's not for any other reasons. Like, I was going to try and do a piece on intelligent design, and I still might, but there was a piece in The New Yorker about intelligent design, and it was perfect. I can't remember who wrote it. I spend most of my life reading stuff and thinking, God, there's a lot of talent out there. Jeez, Louise, people are smart. And feeling brief moments of self-loathing as a result, you know. But when I read this intelligent design piece, it was so perfect. It was so beautifully reported and so smartly and cogently dissected and analyzed that obviously I told JQ that I didn't want to, you know, write my stupid idiot's version thereof. But there's a lot of stuff that I get asked to do, and either I find the prospect of it too scary. 2 years ago, I went for Outside Magazine, I went whitewater rafting in Chile on a Class 5 river. It was, you know, it was beautiful. Ultimately, I kind of had fun, but it was so scary to me. And I just can't do stuff like that anymore. I don't want to do stuff like that anymore. And the great luxury in my life is saying no. Actually, I scratch that. I said no too often. There's 4 years between these books. And part of that is I scared the living daylights out of myself after the first book. I felt that I had really shot my wad, made all my jokes, made all my insights, and that I was tapped out, that I had nothing more to say. And I said no for a good 2-3 years. And I started to, you know, run out of money, because that's how I make my living. And I also started to really be unable to live with myself. So, in fact, I'm trying to say yes more, because it's very nice to be asked, but if you say no enough times, they stop asking, and I can't let that happen in my life.
Aren't there some times where you just have to write a piece about something? I mean, where you feel compelled? Like your naturalization piece seems that way.
Yes, that was a real compulsion. There's also a piece in there about, you know, the fetishization of simplicity that was a compulsion. The Log Cabin Republicans was a compulsion, and the cryonics piece, you know, where I go to Orange County to meet the people who want to freeze themselves afterwards. Although these were ideas that were handed to me, the minute I'm told of them, it does become a compulsion, yes.
You're listening to an interview with David Rakoff, whose collection of essays is titled Don't Get Too Comfortable. Do you ever feel like you want to write more political stuff?
A lot of the stuff is more political than it's been in the past.
Right.
The book is a lot crankier.
Very funny, too.
Oh, thank you very much. The hope for me is that no matter how sort of seemingly shallow and frothy the superficial elements of a story might seem to be, that a politics imbues the way I think about something. So, in fact, when I, you know, go foraging for wild edibles in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, that there is this kind of ultimately political stance on the fact that this sort of historical revisionist fiction that we are all much better, you know, foraging for food is in fact wrong. You know, 15,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, when eventually, you know, the itinerant foragers finally said, hey, you know something, we could actually form a society and civilization if we just sat down and grew the food and we wouldn't starve to death. That's political, you know, somehow exposing what is ultimately a bit of a lie.
In the general media and among essayists, there was a time when a lot of people wrote overtly political stuff. And a lot of that seems to have dropped by the wayside. It's there. It's not as mainstreamed.
This is the thing about seriousness in general. Seriousness in general is no longer perceived to be that socially redeeming of value. It's really all about laughs, which is nice, you know, because I make my living with humor, but I find it a little depressing that a laugh will always win out over something serious. So I think you're right. I think that it's much less. I think that it's perceived to be really highbrow to be serious, seriously political. The fact that the media became so scared of being tarred with the brush of quote-unquote liberal media, and it really terrified them a few years ago, and that's why you can actually accord Swift by Veterans for Truth or intelligent design theorists, I use the term derisively and loosely. That's why you now can accord them equal time, because a kind of a critical acuity has been necessarily and politically disappeared. And I use that as a transitive verb, the way, they disappeared that kind of discourse. It's very scary.
What can someone who does write regularly, like David Rakoff, do?
I'm not smart enough or well-informed enough or wonky enough to really write serious political stuff. So my hope is that on some level, I'm at least piquing somebody's interest to the fact that things are not as they might perhaps ideally be.
You have some pieces, David Rakoff, in your book, Don't Get Too Comfortable, which were clearly assignments, but kind of left me going, oh, this is really, really a cool thing to do, even if he didn't have a good time, or did. I mean, you went on the SST.
Yes, I flew on the Concorde.
It was not impressive.
No, it was cool. I mean, the one thing that's impressive about it is you do arrive, I mean, you leave London, and then you arrive in New York before you even left. That's incredibly cool. And there was also one sort of beautiful, almost poetic thing when you reach your cruising altitude and you're going at twice the speed of sound, which is that there's nothing on the Concorde to divert you. There's no audio program. There's no movie. The plane is incredibly cramped on the inside, so I don't think they can fit anything extraneous in. But what there is there's a readout on the wall at the front of the plane, which tells you your speed and your altitude. And when you're at like somewhere like 53,000 feet or 58,000 feet, which is really high, and it says that you're going Mach 2, and you know that that's something like 1,400 miles an hour. Everybody on the plane, because I was not on a celebrity-studded flight. I was on one of the final flights of British Airways Concorde. So it was all these people who had, like, cashed in miles or cashed in IRAs or 401Ks to really fulfill a lifelong dream. Dozens of people went up to the readout and had their pictures taken in front of it. And their faces were like the faces of children. It was quite extraordinary to see something like aviation, fully a century into its inception, its wonder restored. And that was really cool to me. But in terms of, there were all these myths about the Concorde. Don't touch the walls of the plane, they're super hot from the friction, and there's a red streak that runs through the roof of the cabin.
And they're not true.
They're just not true. And you can see the curvature of the Earth and the stratospheric blue of outer space above you. Simply not true.
So basically it's just a cramped little plane that went very fast and
very,
was
very
totally
fast.
Fuel inefficient.
Well, that's the thing. The great science behind supersonic travel is, burn four times the amount of fuel for one quarter the amount of people. It's not that hard to do.
Another thing you did is you accompanied some models on a photography shoot on a small island hotel off the coast of Belize.
It was a fascinating experience, but I don't respond well to direct sunlight and heat. I find it character distorting. I go crazy if I have to walk through along a sunny street. I burn easily. I overheat, whatever. So it was not my ideal place to be. I'm also not very good at a kind of abandoned hedonism. I don't know. My superego is too strong. I feel too guilty. It's not my ideal thing.
How was being a pool guard in Miami Beach?
Being a pool ambassador in Miami Beach as well was one of these object lessons in do your reading, stay in school, otherwise you're going to have a crappy job. It was boring. That's the thing. It's boring work. You stand there with a clipboard, ready to smile at customers, and guess what? You're invisible to them. And, I'm very, very, very fortunate right now in my life where I'm not invisible. I am seen. The goal of one's life, the goal that really gives people sustenance, is everybody just wants to be seen. You don't want to be invisible. The waiter, that's all you have to do is really just see somebody. So I was very much aware of the fact that, for me, it was posturing for a weekend. I wasn't seen by these people, but I was writing about it. I was seen more than any guest at this hotel.
You were a spy.
I was a spy. And then I got to go public with it, and I got paid for it, and I was very much aware that my situation was so different from the people who were actually doing this for their lives, and it is boring work, and it's a great, great privilege not to have boring work.
You also fasted at one point. Was that an assignment, or was that pretty much David Rakoff deciding he needed to fast?
It was originally done as a radio story for This American Life, PRI. It was something that I had always been interested in, the notion of fasting. I was just interested in the notion of this kind of magic bullet theory. There are such theories throughout culture and psychology and everything. There's always a magic bullet theory. The diet industry is predicated on this. Everything is predicated on the magic bullet theory. And this is meant to be a shortcut to enlightenment, fasting. And I wanted to see if it was true. Although, I have to say, in my heart, I didn't think it was true. But I really approached it with an open mind. I often seem, I'm sure, in my writing, as very opinionated and sort of prejudiced going into something.
But that's after the fact, usually.
It's after the fact. And I really do try, even though I have strong opinions and everything, the reason I would make a terrible lawyer is because I really do often get swayed. If someone presents a cogent argument, I'm like, oh, you know, something, I hadn't thought of it that way. You're absolutely right. That's a horrible lawyer. If you had that lawyer and he's like, you know, they do make you sound kind of guilty, that would be a horrible lawyer to have. So I really did go into this trying my best, even though it seemed like sort of pseudoscience. So I did this fast, which, for the main thing, is really boring. Maybe it's the fact that I come from a food-obsessed family and that I myself am food-obsessed and, you know, body image stuff, but food is a big part of my life. The making thereof, the preparing, giving it to friends, whatever, eating it. So it was really just dull. My world shrank to a kind of, gotta make the broth. Oh, it's time for my herbal tea now. Oh, I get to have 8 ounces of this. It was just dull in that way, and it was narcissistic to an almost killing degree. And as for the enlightenment, the serenity, I felt the serenity, but it was physical. And what I found depressing about that was a lot of the stuff that I had read, you know, testimonials from people who had fasted and all that, didn't talk about it just being physical. They talked about it as being actual enlightenment and serenity. I thought, my God, have we really reached a place where people can't distinguish between lovely, regulated breathing and a kind of physical relaxation and really working on one's problems? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I felt great, or I felt good, I felt fine, I didn't feel starving, but it didn't, for a moment, confuse me about what my real problems were. And I know that my real problems don't really amount to a hill of beans in this world, but they were things that require work. And I hate to say it, but more work than just not eating. That's not work. It's not easy. It takes a long time, and it takes work. Everything in the world. Well, there are two things. If something's really worth it, it's going to take work. And at the same time, oh, this is completely off topic, but my father always reversed that thing, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing well, you know, that old adage. But he said, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. Which for him, what he meant was, there's a nobility in being a beginner at something. But, you know, it does take work. And that, to me, with the serenity fasting, was, it depressed me.
Speaking of that, now that you've written 2 books and you've done all this, do you feel you've finally gotten a handle on writing these things?
No.
Really?
Writing still remains for me extraordinarily difficult. Yeah, it's really scary to me because I don't feel any more like I know what I'm doing than I did, you know, 10 years ago. Although on some level, obviously, I do feel better about it. But, you know, each time the bar feels like it's raised higher, and I keep on waiting for that moment when the jig is going to be up. You know, I called the previous book Fraud. I was joking, but I wasn't kidding. You know, and it's scary to me, and I don't know what to do next. I found this book tremendously more difficult to write.
But it's from reading this book, it's a cut above. Not that there's anything wrong with Fraud, but it's definitely on a higher level than Fraud. I mean, every piece in it, yeah.
Thanks, man. Wow.
I mean, it's true. I mean.
Oh, no. Thank you so much. Wow, I do. Wow. See, but that's the thing. I'm not conscious of that. I'm barely conscious of, you know, I'm always so impressed when I speak to writers or I hear writers speak and they talk about formal considerations and what they had hoped to do, and my feeling is like, oh, it was all I could do to just stay awake during, you know, just not pass out from the anxiety of doing it. It's very strange to me, the whole notion of writing. I find it tremendously difficult.
Do you ever give a thought to writing fiction, either long or short?
I would love to be able to, because, and it's really been on my mind for a variety of reasons. One is that I don't think I can write another collection of essays. I found it very difficult. The thing I love about writing essays and writing collections is it's perfect for someone like myself. I'm a bit of a generalist. Listening to Leanne Hansen, who's on NPR, she said this brilliant thing once. She said, I used to be call myself a dilettante. Then I realized I was a generalist. So I take my cue from her. You know, I love being able to go into something and become a mini expert for like 6 to 8 weeks worth and then move on. You get to learn a ton of stuff. I love that. But I do find reporting tremendously difficult. I find it emotionally taxing to sort of go out there and do that sort of stuff. So I would love to learn how to write fiction so that I could sort of stay home and make it up. I should try, and I really do want to try, and I really will try, although right now fear of failure, as it always does, has me sort of crippled with fear, and I'm just paralyzed. And eventually I might not be, I hope. But also sometimes I encounter real life or just the smallest little thing, and I'm so astonished by the fact, like, wow, I would never have known to make that up.
The other part of writing fiction is you can't put in your fiction the kind of coincidences that take place in real life because it seems too contrived.
Except for Bleak House, you know, in Dickens.
Well, Dickens did it, but Dickens is kind of the, you know, the master of contrived. You can't... What Dickens could do in 1850 or whatever, we cannot do
exactly
150 years later.
And, you know, geniuses make poor examples for the rest of us.
That end of it, right. You know, I mean, I've tried. I've been here at KPFA for 27 years in various
capacities. Since you were 6 years old.
Oh, yeah, sure. And I've tried many times to write it as fiction, and each time I've failed because... Mm-hmm. You can't come up with the stories and the strangeness in fiction that happened at KPFA over the past 3 decades.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
And then the moment you make it real, then you're dealing with lawsuits and research that you can't do.
Yeah.
And you fall into a black hole.
Yeah.
David Rakoff, are you working on more short pieces now for GQ and... Harper's or whatever?
Well, I have to. Certainly right now I'm, you know, on the road and stuff, but I really have to because the book took a lot longer than I thought it would, and I ran out of money. So, you know, I have to hit the ground running, and I really have to make a living.
You've been listening to an interview with David Rakoff, whose book is Don't Get Too Comfortable. David Rakoff can be heard on This American Life, and his pieces pop up in GQ, Outside, and other magazines. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.